Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham and we are heading for the Champions League in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Yes, that's right, last Saturday's brilliant opening day win at Watford has left us in the Champions League places. If we could only hold on for another 37 games. Oh. Meanwhile, back in the real world, our victory over the Hornets equaled our best ever league win on the road, Premier League win on the road, that is, of course, which was at today's opponents, West Ham, who last week shipped 5 goals at home to champions, Man City. So, the Hammers will come to the Amex for what will be Graham Potter's first home game in charge, hungry to get some points on the board. That said, they haven't won a league game in August since 2016. Joining myself and Alan Wares today is not one, but two Raw Virgins, who between them have travelled a massive 3,761 miles to be here today. Firstly, travelling 188 miles, it's from Wolverhampton, we are delighted to welcome the author of the new book, Death in Grimsby, 50 Years of Following Brighton Hove Albion. Please welcome Nick Outerside. And then secondly, travelling a whopping 3,573 miles, we welcome all the way from Toronto, from Seagulls over Toronto, it's Alex Jones.
Great. Hello. Gentlemen.
Anyone got jet lag or pork scratching lag or book launch lag?
Only 36 more bags of pork scratchings to eat, but other than that, I'm fine.
Oh, yes, these are the busting pork scratchings, aren't they? Yeah. So, thanks for coming in, guys. And obviously, you've got a book to plug, and you've just travelled half the way across the road to be, across the world to be here. So
spit your words out, mate. And can I just say that, Aidy, when Aidy's pointing to say that you've come from Wolverhampton, he was pointing at Nick, just for those who don't have super reverb vision on their monitors at the moment.
We really should have a webcam, really.
We really shouldn't. Alex, hello, mate. Welcome to the show. It's at 3,500 miles just to be on Reverb. I mean, that's very impressive. Thank you.
Yeah, well, get my Amex pie as well and hopefully 3 points.
It's interesting you say Amex. Is that the Canadian way?
I think everyone calls it that.
It's funny because John Templeman last night called it that at the book launch.
Did he?
Yeah, he's a local and he's the Amex. And I looked at him and thought, what?
All right. You know. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Okay.
Well, as is tradition with a Raw Virgin, we've got to ask about your Albion supporting history. So we're going to come to you in a second, Nick. But first, Alex, you are actually from Sussex. You just moved to Toronto 2 years ago. Is that right?
Yep. So born and raised in Sussex, been going to the Albion since Withdean days, which obviously was a lot of fun. Then, kind of bad timing for me when we got into the championship in the Amex. I went to university
Falmer.
For
we
3 years.
Yeah.
So I did all the away days in the Midlands and the North, but missed a lot of the home games. And then the year that we got into the Premier League was the year that I moved to Toronto. So bittersweet, but one of the benefits of being in Toronto is that every game is available on TV. So myself and the fellow Seagulls over Toronto, we have a great pub we go to every Saturday. They look after us.
The Queen Beaver.
Queen and Beaver.
No sniggering at the back. What? I don't know if it has the same sort of, you know, the euphemistic connotation here as there, but I mean, do they not see the gag?
Well, it's owned by a British guy, so I'm sure he does, locals probably don't.
Have you ever seen and not seen Naked Gun?
So when you're talking about a group of people then, and we've experienced this as a phenomenon, certainly since we got promoted to the Premier League, that, you know, now that we're a Premier League side, and obviously the Premier League is this massive worldwide sort of corporate marketing sort of wheeze, is that, you know, we pick up fans everywhere, and obviously there's yourself who's there to be,
our man in Toronto.
Basically, our man in Toronto, our preacher who's going to spread the word of the gospel. But, you know, we've picked up people across the States and Canada. So was there the groundswell of support with the Albion in Toronto before the Premier League, or is it just something that's picked up and people have just run with it?
So there's definitely a lot of expats there that have been going since Goldstone, Withdean, etc. There wasn't really any organised meetups because being in League 1 or League 2 Championship, games aren't on TV, no one's shown them. And, you know, even recently, Twitter, Facebook has only really come to fruition. So, like, finding each other was a lot harder. So it's only since the Premier League that we've kind of started meeting up. and it's kind of snowballed. I'd say the majority of us are expats, but then we do have some Americans, Canadians. You guys probably know Andy Bahana. Yeah, so like he came and joined us when New York City were in town, so...
Okay.
Oh, wow.
How many people are you talking about here in Seagulls over Toronto?
So I'd say our regular numbers are about 10 every week.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get to about 15, depending on who we're playing as well. Sometimes people bring friends. I'd say when we first started, we were kind of 4 or 5 every week. So we've kind of doubled, trebled in the last year.
So you are growing it and spreading the word quite literally. And also and as part of your number, you've also got a friend of the show and a former guest on the show, and he's now actually the president of the Canadian FA, and that's Paul Byrne.
Yeah, so Paul used to be, I think he was commercial something maybe at the Albion.
Yeah.
So I reached out to him when I first went to Toronto and met up with him, and he's been down for a couple games, including... the Millwall game where he broke a chair celebrating the Surrey March winner. So, sorry to out you, Paul.
Do tell. Tell me exactly what happened. I mean, did he break it in a Millwall fashion or just a sort of regular exuberant fashion? I've got my sort of like, yeah, you know, the story in my head, but carry on.
And we do know that Paul does listen to this show, so...
So I'd love to say, well, you know, Paul is, you know, a very calm guy. I'd love to say that he, you know, broke it a Millwall way or smashed it over someone's head or something, but it was just a very old chair, and he got up and got down very quickly, and I think one of the legs ended up falling off.
Are we talking about the moment that Solly March's mossy free kick went in, or are we talking about the penalties?
No, it was Solly March's overhit free kick.
Right. Excellent. Well, we're going to come back and talk to you about that a little bit later on. But first, we've also got another Raw Virgin. I can't believe it's your first time in here, actually, Nick. Bearing in mind your heritage of working in the media and on radio, etc. So tell us about your Albion supporting history.
Well, he's written about it.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, I've written about it. 52 years. First game was at the Goldstone, September 1967, against Bury. And I'm finding it quite poignant at the moment. In the next few days, that team that I watch could be going out, well, not a team, the club, could be going out of existence. And it seems to mirror a lot of what happened to us and many other clubs, actually.
Mm.
So that's where it all started. And it's been up and down. Something I had to research for the book is actually how many seasons we've been in the top flight. And it's only 6.
Mm.
You know, 112 other seasons we've been somewhere else.
Yeah. So when you started, what division were we in?
We were the old Division 3.
And tell us about your circumstances. I mean, the long-standing story that a lot of people say is that my dad, my uncle, my granddad took me, stood on an orange box at the east, on the East Terrace. Is that your experience?
No, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a lifelong Newcastle United supporter. He's a former miner. And I think probably because he had it thrust down his neck as he grew up, my father hated football.
Oh.
Just despised it. Was much rather...
Are we talking about the Sussex lad now? You said your grandfather's from Newcastle.
Yeah, they moved south during the Depression.
Right.
My dad was born in 1930. Mm. He preferred watching boxing. He's a massive Muhammad Ali fan. Golf, anything but football. So there was me growing up at a primary school in Port Slade, surrounded by friends who were all into football. They knew more about the Albion than I did at the age of 10. But I yearned for it. And when I went on then to grammar school at 11, it was, of course, the bus used to go, on the way back, used to go past the Albion ground. When we went to Brighton shopping, and I'd look down for the upper deck and think, that's it there.
Hmm.
And that's as far as it went until it was the end of the summer of 67. And my mum came up to me and she said, you know David Knott? And I sort of, yes, he's a guy who lived down the road. Well, would you like to go to watch the Albion with him? And sort of, it was like amazing. It was like going to the moon. And I can't remember now, but I do remember.
The pitch wasn't that bad.
It was amazing.
So it was kind of like a eureka moment.
It was, totally. It was just I remember so excited. I don't think I slept the night before. And that's happened a few times since.
Yeah,
And anyway, he took me to my first game. I think he would normally be at the middle at the back of the north stand, but he put us down at the front so I could see. And I just transfixed, totally transfixed. The the sight, the sound, the colours.
So you see, your first game, you're actually in the North Stand, because normally that's a rite of passage. So you normally start.
Well, I think the guy who took me, he was about 34. That's where he always went.
Right. So was there an orange box down at the front, just so you could stand?
Not quite that. I wasn't that small, but yes. Right. No, I could see.
Sure. Because obviously, you know, in the North Stand, you used to climb up the steps, past the kiosks / toilets, which were, you know, sort of like this river of filth. And I'm not talking about the toilets here. So you go up the stairs, then you're at the back of the North Stand, and then you're looking down. I mean, I certainly remember it in my time, you know, in the 70s. But, you know, when you think of the 60s and you look back on them, you can see them, it's all in black and white. Yeah. Was it sort of like a sort of like this vast ocean of sort of luminous green ahead of you?
It was that the ocean of colour.
Mm.
And then to see that when the Albion came out and the shirts we had then, which were the blue bodice and the white sleeves, mm-hmm. and this blaze of blue came out onto the grass.
Sure.
And I think from memory, Bury were playing in white. And it was that, and I was just transfixed by all of it. The colour of the ball was a white football, and it all happened so fast.
The singing and...
I didn't really progress to that until later when I got sort of... I could hear noises from the back,
right.
But I didn't quite make it all out. I mean, I understood that the referee didn't have a father.
Sure.
But other than that, I didn't really get into the chance until, well, as the season progressed, and I was eventually able to sort of graduate further back into the stand.
So when I first went in 1978... And I've written about this before, is that the amount of Anglo-Saxon that you heard from grown-ups, I assume that only naughty school kids swore in the playground. You think that adults had grown out of it by then. No, not a bit of it. So was that kind of the thing you had then? Did you feel like a boy in a man's world?
Yes, very much so. And as you got to know the chants as well.
Mm.
And in fact, when you got to an age, you got to a point in that season, probably when I was turned 12, coming on towards 13, and I could join in with the chants.
Without getting a clip round the ear.
The thing is, 50 years later, probably the chants haven't actually changed that much.
I think they were more imaginative in then. Certainly in the 70s. Yeah. The thing is, back then,
it was more of a community thing. And they, all these songs used to be born out of the pubs and stuff. And it's not so much... you don't really have that so much anymore.
There was less of the songs. There were much more chants.
Yeah.
I mean, the only song I can remember was the one for Charlie Livesey, which went to the old Al Jolson's... number Mammy.
All right.
I go a million miles for one of your goals, old Charlie. but the rest were just straightforward chants. Yeah. And it was pull the chain, flush him away, and things like that. It was very, very basic.
Blimey.
Now, Alex, obviously your first forays into watching the Albion were with Dean. So can you remember your first game then?
I think it might have been possibly a Boxing Day game. And I remember it because Charlie Oatway
against QPR
got snapped by, I think it was Danny this isn't a swear word. Danny Shittu.
Yeah.
So I remember that one, yeah.
The curse of broadcasters everywhere, that bloke, isn't it?
But yeah, no, that was against QPR. I think we won 4-0, didn't we?
I think that was a 2-1 game. Leon Knight scored, yes. I mean, it was kind of irony of ironies that basically Charlie Oatway got his career ended by playing for QPR, yeah.
With that name, yeah.
But, I mean, again, was yours a rites of passage, or were you a little bit older? Or tell us about your circumstances.
Yeah, my dad went to the Goldstone, and, you know, big Albion fan. And then when I kind of, you know, hit the right age, he started taking me to Withdean, and yeah, I loved it. You know, obviously it wasn't the best conditions, and we'd take our pack of Mac and our plastic trousers in case the heavens opened. But, you know, I enjoyed it, and it was quite nice being that kid at school that, you know, people like, what, you went to Oldham? Like, yeah, of course I did, yeah. So. Yeah.
I mean, that's the weird thing about, you know, us talking, you're talking about sort of like, you know, wearing your pack-a-mac, you know, with Dean because you've got soaked. I suppose it might have been the difference because you're sitting down in an open thing. But if you're on the East Terrace at the Goldstone, you're going to get just as soaked, weren't you, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And at most of the grounds we visited as well. And, I was having the same conversation, I think, last week with somebody, and... what is the big difference? The big difference is the way we're looked after as fans now. And back then we weren't. Mm. You know, we paid our 1 and 6 months or whatever it was then, went through the turnstiles, and you fought for yourself
once you're inside. I mean, the ground. But also back in those days as well, you've got to consider that the numbers coming through the gates, that's what paid the players' wages pretty much. These days, it is the money that is generated by the supporters.
But it's the commercialisation of football, full stop.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, we're going to come back to that whole point where you mentioned there, which is the fact with Bury and the fact that this is still allowed to happen now.
Well, don't get me started on that.
And it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Did you hear Colin Murray and our good friend Kieran Maguire on Radio 5 this week, or yesterday I think it was? I mean, you referred to Steve Dale at Bury as pound shop Ken Bates, and I thought that Colin Murray was going to explode on air. And Kieran was actually the voice of sanity and reason. But yes, it's absolutely embarrassing and shameful that it's actually still happening.
I mean, Colin Murray actually wrote a very good piece in the Metro this week. He is a massive supporter of the Football League and the fact that there should be some sort of way of the money that goes into the top league to filter through, which it doesn't really do anymore. It used to happen through transfers and stuff, but that's another story for another day. But what we do have to actually talk about is the fact that last week, it was the first day of the season, and we went to Watford, we're excited. And now, normally, the first day of the season, you know, in when we look back in our misty-eyed vision, it's always sunny and everyone's wearing shorts. Me, I woke up to 60 mile an hour winds and picking up bits of pet fence from my garden.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It was, but we eventually got to Watford, and obviously it was Graham Potter's first league game in charge for us. And were you surprised by his team selection, Nick?
No, actually, I wasn't. I was surprised that he didn't play one or two of the signings, but I'd seen him a couple of times pre-season, particularly at Birmingham. When he first started playing this three-man, or this back three, and I was so impressed with the way it worked. And so I can see him going down that avenue, and I was thinking earlier on about the number of centre-backs we've now got. We've got about sort of five top-class centre-backs plus about three others. So is he going down that avenue now of playing three at the back with a couple of really fast wing-backs? I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the story with Matt Clark and Adam Webster is a curious one, really, because it was... When he was signed by Ipswich, it was Matt Clark that went in the opposite direction then as well. So, I mean, those two seem to be following each other outdoors at the moment, which is a bit strange. But Adam Webster was on the bench, and there's only actually one league debut in that team, and that was Dan Byrne, who was with us last year. And it was actually all of that team was with us last year. So, I mean, perhaps the one to surprise us was Pascal Gross starting.
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't think you could ever actually consider a surprise, bearing in mind that, you know, Graham Potter's had an entire pre-season. I mean, you know, Chris Hughton was sacked the day after the season finished, and Potter was with us the following week, you know, and had the opportunity to instil his ideas on players. What I'm most impressed with is not just Potter's ideas, which are great, but also the speed at which the players are actually taking to it. And it's still a work in progress. I mean, he said himself afterwards, they weren't perfect, and there are lots of things that they still need to work on. Defensive frailties, ironically enough, being one of them. And as Nick was saying, it's about sort of playing three at the back and the various different tasks you have to have. So I don't think that, one, there was a lot of players that came in, well, because there was a lot of players that came in during that week, it's not right to embed them. They haven't had that time to train with the squad. Two, because they haven't done that, you've got to go with what's familiar. He's had this entire pre-season with those players. Now, the ones he's brought in will start. But Pascal Gross, he's obviously sort of... It might be a difference of being playing away or home. You know, Watford are a big, robust sort of side. You know, Troy Deeney is a big sort of, you know, tank of a player. So I think, you know, that's even starting Murray and Lacardia up front. They're big sort of robust players. By the time they battered their defence, on come Maupay and Andoni, and we see what happens. So no, in the great scheme of things, that's a long-winded way of saying no, I'm not surprised at that lineup.
Now, Alex, the thing with Pascal was, and we were saying this pre-season, was we thought that he might possibly be the fall guy in Potter's style because of his perceived lack of pace, but he was absolutely magnificent on Saturday.
Yeah, I think he does have a lack of pace, but when you bear in mind his quality on the ball and his delivery and his famous Gross turn, you know,
that's in slow motion.
if we're playing with, you know, Murray and Lacardia, we need someone to get balls into the box, which Pascal was one of the best at. And I think with the way that Montoya is playing, you know, he's playing as almost as far up as Gross, so Gross can drift in a bit more and leave that space, so I don't think it's a problem.
Before we carry on, we have to ask, what time did you have to get up to get to the Queen Beaver?
I'm quite lucky, so I live nearby, so I get up around 9-ish. Some of the other guys come in a bit further, they're probably up around 7, but I get up at 9, get there, my full English, have a pint, it's pretty good.
Sounds like hell, doesn't it? Yeah. It does sound like hell. No, it doesn't. No, but the point is I think what we've got to consider is that, you know, the clearest difference that we can see is the fact we're playing a back three. That is a clear setup consideration. But all the things that we've actually looked at before, playing 4-4-2 or 4-5-1, and they have been fluid with even with that. We've got a back three, we've got two wing backs, and what are the other five doing? We don't know. We're not sure because it's quite fluid. And there's a difference between when we have the ball and press, and when we don't press and when we have the ball and do press and the nature of the press. Everyone's got a different role this time, and I think as fans are going to have to look at, you know, if we're going to analyse the game to see how that works. It is an entirely different thing. Everyone has a new role within sort of like where they're supposed to be at a given moment.
But I mean, given the fact that we don't really want to criticise Chris Hughton because he did a magnificent job for us, but I mean that the personnel that was put on the pitch on Saturday, apart from the most expensive bench in our history, which we'll come to in a second, but that was all that personnel was available to Chris Hughton.
It's the mindset, it's the confidence, isn't it? I mean, I was quite surprised to not see Bernardo playing, because I think he's been outstanding at left back, or left wing back as he'd be now. But to see Solly March there instead, it was a revelation. The big change for me, for the same man, is Lucardia. I mean, Lucardia's been panned for a season and a half now for being lazy, goal shy, and for everything I've seen of him since the middle of closed season, he's hungry, he's working really hard behind the ball, and I think he's a real revelation, and that can only be due to Potter.
And you saw his performance at Birmingham, of course. Obviously pre-season games you can't read but I mean the goal he scored there was absolutely magnificent.
It's more the work rate, I think, for me. He's chasing the ball, and that goal at Birmingham was superb.
Okay, Al, for the first 15 minutes of the game, it did look like we were trying to find our way a little bit, but from that quarter hour mark onwards, our midfield started to get hold of the game a lot more.
I think you've seen that in a lot of games. You know, the home team, they're on the front foot, they've got to impress, it's the first game of the season, blah, 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 all those various things, and yeah, we're taking a moment to get used to them. And the trick is obviously not to concede, and, you know, they were taking pot shots from the edge of the area, and, you know, that was that. And you're quite right, once we actually got into it and worked out who was supposed to be where and what was happening, you know, they'd have changed their system, their setup, as the game went on, but we could adapt accordingly. But this is Graham Potter's first game in charge. This is the first competitive. Sorry, it's the first competitive game in charge. It's a relatively easy one. It's not an easy one, but we're not playing Man City away. We're not playing Liverpool away, where you do risk an absolute hiding if you're not 100% sure of the jobs that you're doing. But the point is that I'm not convinced. And again, listening to Gray Sear after the game, I was in the press conference afterwards. He said, you know, he held his hands up and said Brighton were better. And I can't help thinking he didn't do his homework, because you saw the way that Watford was set up. They were poor, and they're not going to be that poor again. But I just think that Potter did a number on him, because I don't think that, you know, as the game went on, you saw that Watford were running out of ideas, and we were looking so much more comfortable.
Now, Alex, we were saying on this show pre-season about the players that we thought might come to the fore under with Potter, and obviously again, at this point in the season, we've played one game and one squad doesn't make a summer, etc, etc. But one player that we earmarked for being one to watch in this particular system would be Davy Prupper, and he was pivotal in that performance on Saturday.
Yeah, as he is every week. I saw on North Stand chat, which maybe not the best place to always look for views of players, but he was getting some stick last year, and I was thinking, you know, he's probably our best player week in, week out.
Yes, but his hair got magnificent comments, says he.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think Davy Prupper is one of those players that, you know, again, kind of similar to Stevens, because what they're doing isn't necessarily the same as what Grossways does, which, you know, is some of those turns and the crossing and whatnot.
Eye-catching stuff.
Yeah. So I think even more important in this system is going to be Stevens and Prupper or Moy and whoever, because, you know, as you say, it's the press, it's the transition from attack into defence. You know, as always, I thought he was excellent.
The thing that really struck me is when we were 1-0 up. Now, this had happened a year ago, we'd have defended that 1-0 lead. But you're seeing seven players, including Prupper and Stevens, in their box. You know, seven players in their box, and we're defending a 1-0 lead. And that's a real change.
I mean, the difference, the thing is, Graham Potter is getting all the plaudits for sort of putting on two forward players, but all I saw was a like-for-like change. I thought that Murray and Lacardi had kind of run out of steam. You know, they're big, robust players, and they spend their time being battering rams more than anything.
Well, that's exactly it, because they're not like-for-like, are they? I mean, yes, they are strikers. Striker for striker, yes, but you've got two stodgy players and two fast players.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So in that sense, you've got that. And I take Nick's point that, yes, once upon a time, you know, another midfielder would have come on for a striker, and what we have, we hold, and fine, and we win ugly. And let's face it, we got very, very lucky with the first goal, but, you know, they all happen.
Okay, well, let's talk about that first goal then. 28 minutes in, Albion take the lead, and our first goal of the season is an own goal. Now, none of us would have predicted that, but, you know, that's what happened. And it was Lacardi who found Stevens on the edge of the box, and his lofted pass is too high for Murray. Grace picks up the loose ball and fires across the box, and it's turned in by Decore, with Murray waiting to pounce on his shoulder.
Now originally, when I saw that, I actually thought it was that Murray was offside, but I've since seen it back on the Match of the Day and realised he wasn't. So
if the Murray was offside when the original ball came in,
no, so he wasn't. That's my point. No, he wasn't. I actually thought he was. He was actually a little bit behind him, and then when ball came in.
Yeah, when the ball from Stevens.
Oh, we wouldn't have been given for that because it went nowhere near him. No, it's the ball from Gross I'm talking about, the one that went across the area that Decore knocked in. I actually originally thought that Murray was offside. Looking back on Match of the Day, it doesn't matter. Someone else scored. Hey, they all count. But the point is that we had, as you said, four or five players in the box at that time, so which is a real change.
Yeah, and again, Nick, I mean, we were talking about the impact of Gross. Now, in his first season, he was seven goals he scored and nine assists. Struggled a little bit last year for form and with injuries. First game of the season, one assist already for him.
Yeah, and I'm wondering what's going to happen with Trossard. I mean, will Gross and Trossard interchange by matches? And it'll depend on the tactics that Potter uses, and I can understand why he played Gross last weekend at Watford. I wouldn't be surprised if Trossard takes his place today, but I don't know.
Mm. Alex?
I actually think Trossard might take Lacardia's place today.
Okay, cool.
Interesting.
I agree that Lacardia has looked sharp in pre-season, and I think he's shown, like, the goal against Birmingham, against Millwall in the FA Cup last year. If you get him in around the box, he's going to score goals. But I think, as we kind of mentioned, he's a bit more physical and beefier than Trossard. I think today against West Ham, who have similar forward players that are very light and quick and deft, I think, you know, we'll try and match that.
Okay. Now, obviously, with this system, it's still early days for the players. They're still getting used to it. And we did concede chances in this game. Now, one player that myself and Al at the time highlighted is, even though it was a great team performance, one that
I thought the weak point was Solly March, yeah.
And Solly got very, very lucky when he was trying to see out the ball.
Yeah, you could see as it was trundling, you think, this isn't going out. I'd stick it in row Z or stick it behind for a corner. But the thing is, that what worries me about that is this is a professional footballer who could not judge the speed of the ball when it's at his feet. That's what worries me. He thought that he was actually going to be able to knock it out. And, you know, your man pounced. And Solly March is better than that. And we're back to what we were talking about early pre-season, is that Solly March is either brilliant or he could be maddening. Yeah. I think that at times during that game, especially when, because we're in the press box, there's obviously the away fans, but we're in the press box and we're kind of halfway between the halfway line and the penalty area.
The gutter and the stars, mate. The gutter and the stars.
Well, I'm not sure we're at the back of it. And, and Watford's is the one ground that I think most looks like a nightclub. So we're at the kind of the Albion end. And so we could see Solly March on this side, you know, in the second half. And there was a lot of times he was in space and really, really didn't want to get the ball forward. It was quite frustrating. Montoya was doing it a little bit. I mean, in the first half, Montoya had so much space out wide. And as good as Montoya has been sort of considered for this game, I actually thought we could have got a lot more out of him. Again, he had so much space, and I thought that his supporting players around him, maybe it was them, or maybe the fact that actually go forward 10 yards, and March wouldn't do it, Montoya wouldn't do it, certainly not in the first half. So, yeah, March needed, I think, a little bit of a kick up the backside. He actually looked a little bit, ironically, he looked a little bit lost in that position, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about him last season as eventually becoming a wing back, and obviously Potter was listening to the show and obviously put him in that position, clearly. But yeah, I mean, the jury's out on Solly on that one. One thing that we were particularly frightened about going into this game and into this season, indeed, was that dreaded three letter word, or three initials, if you will, VAR. Now, it was implemented in this game, and now obviously there has been talk about how it's going to work in the stadium and stuff. And there, actually, we saw a couple of things, but speaking to other people, the game completely missed. There was one, it came up.
Well, it's not announced. It's on the scoreboard, but the point is they don't make an announcement for it, and I think probably nor should they. I think it was a challenge from Troy Deeney on one of our players. I think it was Montoya, and he clattered him, and they're checking for a red card. Yeah.
And another one was there was a Pereira free kick which was played into the wall, and they claimed handball.
That was done away with quickly. I mean, you saw a match of the day; it did hit his arm, but in a natural position. And
he wasn't trying to make his body bigger, basically.
Yeah, I think the way it works is that if arm had been there rather than there. So you cannot see
for
this on the radio.
For those not watching in super reverb vision, Nick has just put his arm up about level with his shoulder.
Yeah, I've now brought it down to my waist. Yeah. And that is the difference between a handball and not a handball.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, it was going to hit. Oh, is it Duffy? It was going to hit his chest.
It was Murray.
Okay. Great. The ball seems to be a magnet for him in the penalty area when it comes to that. But yeah. VAR wasn't too invasive this time, it was used, and you could clearly see that the players were celebrating, and while they were doing, they were checking for it, and obviously each goal was perfectly legitimate.
I'm still trying to work out how the hell Pereira didn't get booked though for that, because he was he had his hands behind his back, but he was shouting, he was following around like a lost puppy.
Well, I'd imagine that's the sort of thing the manager would get angry about, is, you know, play to the whistle, get on with the game. I mean, that was actually seriously unprofessional.
Yeah, but I mean, Pereira should have been booked for ranging the ref like that, under the new rules, he definitely should have been.
I mean, if he'd have done that.
Yeah, he would have been.
Done
that
square. There's your reverb thing with these, together. Sorry, doing that again.
Explain. Alan's now made the shape of a square.
Yes, okay. With his fingers. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on from there anyway. And obviously, the headline news for this game was probably the fact that, like you said, that the attacking substitutions, and it didn't take long for those substitutions to take effect. And in fact,
Alex, all yours. Explain. Describe. Well, from Toronto.
I think you summed up perfectly. Murray and Lacardia, although play the same positions as Maupin and Doné, they're very different players. And Maupin and Doné, a lot sharper, different kind of movement. And, you know, it was the right stage in the game to, as you said, Watford kind of ran out of ideas. And it was either do what Houghton would have done, which, you know, bring on a midfielder, we hold what we have, or go, okay, well, actually, they're vulnerable. Let's get some pace on some new movement and, you know, instant work.
Now, Nick, going through pre-season, Andoni was probably the forgotten man, and and you probably didn't see him featuring that much because all the headline news was going to be was about the new striker, about Morpay coming in, etc. But I mean, he comes on, scores with his first touch. What more do you want?
We saw some flashes of absolute Andoni brilliance last season, but there were only flashes. He wasn't given the extended run, and he wasn't being played probably as a perfect number 10 behind Murray. And now we're seeing another flash. Let's hope it continues. I mean, the goal against Palace at home last season was out of this world. I mean, it was just
which
out of
one?
This world. I mean, the run down the touchline, the way he cut, and he said, I think his interview after the match then was, I don't think they realise how fast I am. He is. He's a very quick.
I think
player.
It's more saying he doesn't realise how slow James Tonkins is. Well,
yeah. But I mean, it was absolutely. And let's talk about Davy Purper in that as well, and that jig and firing the ball across the 6 yard box. He made it so easy for Andoni to just to get just anything on the ball.
But we had a forward going across the defender at near post. Sorry, go on, Alex. You scream.
Yeah, no, I was saying that's exactly it. That's you know, last year Proper would have got in that position, looked up, and thought, okay, Glenn Murray is there. Probably stationary.
Alex is pointed to the desk here. By that point,
we've got the sword of the on here. He's moving the figures.
Yeah, we had three or four guys all running in. And as my dad always says, you know, pull the ball back to the penalty spot, and you're likely to score. And you know, he drilled it in. People forget he's a Dutch international. Like, he has quality.
Something you mentioned about 10 minutes ago is that about Stevens as well. I mean, Stevens and Proper are both naturally attacking midfielders. Mm. I mean, when Stevens came to us, 5 years ago now, or however long it was, he was well known for his passes from...
It was a box-to-box midfielder.
Yeah, absolutely. Both of them were sort of pulled back to be defensive midfielders in the last season and a half. So for now, Proper, we're seeing the real Proper.
Well, so we might be able to unlock the potential, is basically.
Well, I think that goes back to what you were saying about Solly March and Montoya. Not to take shots at Chris Houghton, but he moulded those players to suit his system, which was more defensive based. So, you know, Montoya, he got in great positions, but then he didn't look like he had a clue what to do. Mm-hmm. I think as he progresses through the season, and you know, he's more used to being in and around the box, I think he was through on goal at one point and just kind of, you know, I think he'll improve.
I think that's that was the point, wasn't it? We were 3-0 up at one point and we were going for a fourth, and it's Montoya on the edge of the box. What are you doing there?
But okay, but another part of that that double attacking substitution was a debut for Neil Maupay, or Maupay as we like to call him, sponsored by Piglets, and he got a debut goal, but it's not about, I mean, obviously a weak score. Hey, we scored a 1-1, hello. And secondly, Lewis Dunk, take a bow, son, take a bow. What a ball, what a ball.
Yeah, we've seen Dunk do that before on occasions, but again, the last two seasons, he's been pulled back more and more as being a stopper or a blocker alongside Duffy. But I can remember three seasons ago, Dunkey often playing those long through balls. Was it, I can't remember, it was Brentford or Fulham, where he burst through on a solo run through the middle of their defence. We got the equaliser.
Okay, so we left 3 points, three goals, clean sheet.
But more than that, I think more than anything, it's the fact that, and it's not, again, not to criticise Houghton, he got to where he did, and he's given, let's put it this way, Graham Potter would not be able to have done what he did without Chris Houghton getting as far as he could. That squad that's been assembled, we could argue that it's been misused. Listen, we've seen it for one game. All right, we've seen flashes of it in the pre-season. We've seen it for one game. One swallow doesn't make a pawn start, and we've got to work out from here on in, you know, what's going to happen. We don't know, you know, it could easily come undone against West Ham. Yes. You know, we don't know, and against Southampton.
So we can't get too carried away.
No, we can't. But the point is that we do know what they can do. And if that's the platform from which the rest of the season is launched, we're in for an exciting season.
I do know one thing.
Do tell.
You're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As usual, we are delighted to be brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And I'm just going to pass this week's shirt of the week over to Nick to describe for me.
Go on, Alex, you have a go as well.
Great. It's a combination of Ipswich, Portsmouth.
It looks like half of it is a tea towel.
Yes, it does. Yeah. That's the apron at the bottom.
Yes,
it's
it
it's in anyway. For
it's
the listeners,
description.
It's blues, different shades, about three different shades of blue, with a red and black stripe across the middle, and some sort of curtain pattern across underneath.
Yeah,
that.
It kind of looks a little bit Sampdoria, doesn't it? But it's
and a butcher's apron under that. The second half is definitely a blue and white striped butcher's apron.
Okay, so and it says what across it, Alex?
Food Town.
Okay, so anyone want to hazard a guess as to whose shirt this is?
It's not something. Well, if it's Food Town, not worn by Maupay.
No.
If I had to guess, I would go maybe Ipswich or Sheffield Wednesday.
Incorrect. I reckon it's some non-league side because, I mean, it's an English sort of, you know, sponsor. So I'm going to say some obscure northern town that Thatcher closed down in the 80s.
It is a northern town.
This
Nick.
Isn't a Grimsby away shirt.
Yes, it is.
Oh my goodness.
There you go.
Grimsby written across AD's eyes then. So,
so this is what Phil has to say about this. Here you go then, gents. No tongue twisters for AD today. Thank you, Phil. This is the 1996-1997 away shirt of the Mighty Mariners, more commonly known as Grimsby Town. A delight of mid-90s scramble design. I have no idea what the colours are, because he's colourblind, says Phil. But the Lotto designer obviously had his geometric shapes template to hand. Grimsby were formed in 1879 and have played at Blundell Park, which is in Cleethorpes, since 1898. The ground currently has a capacity of 9,052, but has a record attendance of over 31,000 back in 1937. A bit similar to the Goldson back when that was closed.
Yeah.
But most of Grimsby's more impressive history is in the distant past. They played over 10 seasons in the top flight, the last being the 1938-39 season. Bill Shankly was their manager between 51 and 54 before his move to Liverpool. But the most unusual historical fact I could find is that they played an FA Cup semi-final against Wolves in 1939.
I have a record of this.
Go on.
The highest ever attendance at Old Trafford.
Yes, it was. It was, the crowd was 76,962, which to this day is the largest crowd ever to have watched a football match at Old Trafford. Some Brighton links for you. Former goalkeeper Paul Crichton was a Grimsby player of in 94-95, and he worked at the Albion in 2008-2009 as a goalkeeping coach, of course, and he was also signed as an Albion player as well. Another Albion goalkeeping link was the evergreen Dave Besant, made 6 appearances for Grimsby in 1992 whilst on loan from Chelsea. And another, Wayne Henderson, played between the sticks 14 times whilst on loan from Preston in 2009. Albion's own miracle man Russell Slade had 2 stints as manager at Blundell Park in 2004-2006 and 17-18. For something slightly more obscure, Lee Nogan, older brother of former Albion striker Kurt Nogan, made 70 appearances. There you go. Thanks for that.
Thanks. So just point out that this show is sponsored by oldfootballshirts.com. That's Phil and Mark Shelley. So there's over 100,000 shirts that the people have just posted up on that from across the world. And obviously this is one of them. Thank you very much indeed for your support, Phil. Absolutely brilliant. But talking of Grimsby, Nick.
Hello. Thanks for the lead in for this.
Not at all. Tell us what you've been up to lately.
Well, I've just published a book called Death in Grimsby, 50 Years Following Brighton and Hove Albion.
Which he's actually holding up now.
the official launch was last night in Worthing, where old Albion player John Templeman turned up as a guest of honour, and the night before at the Caxton Arms here in Brighton, and where we had both Andy Rollings and Brian Tors turn.
I think the Caxton's been renamed now, very much like Derby was last year. It's now Brett Mendoza's Caxton. Yes.
Yeah, Brett's gaff. It's so the book has been launched. It came about, in a nutshell, about a year ago. A good friend of mine, Alan Willard, who is the curator of the Albion Room, was pumping books to buy for Christmas. And one of the books he pumped was Albion on the Up by Nick Outerside. And I immediately messaged him and said, Alan, I've never written a book called that. He had the wrong Nick. The messaging sort of carried on that day. And he said, well, why don't you write a book? And I've written a few books, but none about my one passion in my life. It just passed me by. It wasn't even on my radar to write a book about the Albion. I'd written a few magazine columns for the former Albion Mag, so I had something to start with, but I had no idea where to start. I mean, there are so many really good books out there written about our club.
I mean, just to give you some background to you as well, Nick. I mean, you've been you were for over 32 years. You worked across all forms of media, and you are an award-winning writer. I mean, you've won, was it North of England Daily Journalist of the Year, Scottish Daily Journalist of the Year, Scottish Weekly Journalist of the Year. So you obviously went from weekly to daily.
Yeah, back again. Yeah.
I mean, that's quite impressive. And apparently someone like in 94, 43 MPs signed an early day motion to praising your research and writing.
Yeah, that's journalism. Ooh. That's journalism. And then it all ended... that's about to say tragically, it wasn't. It all ended in 2013, and I took early retirement and scrabbled around what to do. And I really lost my way for about 2 or 3 years. I did some PR work. I had to set up a PR agency. But it wasn't, number one, it wasn't fulfilling. Number two, it wasn't earning me any money. And I retired for ill health. And my GP suggested I wrote. And I did. I started writing, and I published 2 books of poetry, which I now look upon and think, oh my God, why did I write that? And then one thing led to another. I then started editing books and publishing books for other people. And I'd had other books going in the background. So when Alan Willard came up with this idea last October, I thought, well, all these great historical books about our club have been written already. I mean, Tim Carter has written some amazing books. And Bloody Southerners last year was an outstanding book. That was, I can't even compete with those. And I didn't know where to start. And I thought, well, all I can do is tell my own story. And so I thought about the 50 years, or now 52 years, I've been following the Albion. I'll just do it chronologically. And there's far too many games to give a chapter to each game. So I had to think about games that affected me personally, something that happened to tie in with those games. I mean, one of the chapters was a 0-0 draw at Carlisle in 2001. And I took my 2 daughters, who were then aged 7 and 8, to their very first game. And on the way to the game, they saw hundreds and hundreds of cows in a field gathered together. And they were pointing out the window, look at those cows. And of course, I knew what was happening to those cows. This was at the middle of the foot and mouth outbreak.
Yeah.
And I said, well, aren't they nice? And we went to the game, 0-0 draw, which pretty well secured us promotion from the old third division or League 3, wherever we were then. On the way back, the cows are gone, and the first thing my daughters said were, where are all the cows, Daddy? and beyond them over the hill I can see the plume of black smoke. And trying to explain that to little children, and I think I said they've gone in for their tea. So that, for me, was an important point about that particular chapter, even though the game itself was a tedious nil-nil draw.
So how did you come up with the title Death in Grimsby?
You've already alluded to, I've been in journalism for far too many years, so I started to give each title what I thought was like a newspaper headline. So the first chapter about me is seeing Brighton play Bury was called Popping My Cherry in Bury. There's another chapter about Kit Napier getting his shirt ripped off his back, and the offender there was a guy called George Lay. So the chapter was called Lay Off Kit's Shirt. Mm. Get to chapter 13. And
I'm surprised you didn't go Lay Lady Lay name in yours. Could have been.
Chapter 13 was a game in Grimsby in 2004, Valentine's Day. It was the midst of the campaign for Falmer, and other people, not me, had arranged to deliver this huge Valentine's card to John Prescott, who was then Deputy Prime Minister, to his constituency office in Hull. By chance, that same day, we were playing Grimsby away. Mm. So the car was delivered in the morning. I got a new car that week. I'd not transferred the contents of my old car to the new one. So when I got to Hull, first of all, then Grimsby, I realised I had nothing to wear other than the football shirt I'm wearing now. So I got out of the car, got soaking wet, drove across the Humber Bridge, went to the game, spent the whole game wet and cold, trying to keep myself warm with cups of Bovril, meat pies, anything. Got back to my car even colder, sat in a puddle of water in the seat. And the next bit I can vaguely remember is starting the car, driving about a mile alongside Grimsby Docks. I somehow, and I don't know how I did it to this day, managed to stall an automatic car. the next thing I remember was waking up in A&E at the Princess Diana Hospital in Grimsby. Apparently a passerby had seen his body slumped over the steering wheel, called the ambulance, etc. When I woke, I had a drip in my arm, I had a space blanket around me and something else, and I was told then by the doctor that I was 0.01 of a degree of having hypothermia.
Christ.
So I called the chapter Death in Grimsby. I could have called it Almost Dead in Grimsby, but it wouldn't have had the same ring.
Well, I think everyone is, aren't they?
Yes.
That's the point.
I sleep with the fishes, something like
that. Yeah,
this.
Yeah. Frozen fish fingers, yeah. But, I mean, Alex, I mean, we'll get back to Nick's story in a minute, but, I mean, it's so wonderful that... it's not so wonderful that we've had these trials and tribulations, but it's so wonderful that there are so many books that we can actually chronicle, such wonderful contemporary accounts of... I mean, you must have several Albion books you've read.
Yeah, I think it makes it that much sweeter, the fact that we have all these stories and, you know, Build a Bonfire and the recent one, Albion Up. I think a lot of fans, especially in Toronto, you know, they don't necessarily realise, they just see Albion as a Premier League club and think, oh, you know, nice stadium, good sponsor, good players. They don't really realise
the
history.
Here's the thing. So basically what you could do is go around knocking on people's doors with a copy of Build a Bonfire and go, hello, I was wondering if you'd like to talk about Brighton. No, maybe not.
No.
It's really in the gospel.
No, I know what you're saying, yeah, but it was really bad. Sorry, carry on, Alex.
I lend some books to my friends, actually. I have friends that are big fans. I have a Danish friend, send him some books. Again, it's just spreading the word, as you say, and people don't necessarily understand that although where we are now is amazing, we had some pretty dark times.
I mean, the story of how we got here is the stuff of legends. So if, you know, you could actually be one of Canada's biggest book importers at this rate. So actually just say, right, okay, I'm going to set up, you know, Jones's bookstore, and it's going to be nothing but Brighton books, because there's an awful lot.
Yeah. But the thing is, Alex, to appreciate where we are now, you have to look back to where we came from. And that 20-year journey is something that we still talk about. We can't forget that, particularly where we were talking about the stories with the likes of Bury and Bolton at the moment, which is like no lessons have been learned from that point. So we need to be there and need to pass on our experiences to these clubs to help them try and get out of this.
I think what really strikes me is that before our crisis in 1997, I think there's only been one other I can remember before that. It was Aldershot, I think, 92 when they went bust. They were probably one of the
I think
others.
I've made Stern as well. You had Wolves in the 80s. They crashed and burned. I remember actually talking to Wolves fans, and they said they didn't give a flying monkeys about our consideration because no one gave a monkeys about them back in the 80s. They crashed all the way to the fourth division through bad ownership. So theirs was a kind of a wake-up call to the rest of us. We reached out.
Yeah.
That's probably why our story is so incredible, is because we reached out in ways that, I mean, Aldershot wasn't such a big club. Ours was probably the biggest club, with the exception of Wolves, which I can think everyone sort of kind of overlooked. Ours was the biggest club that was actually, you know, I think, oh my God, Brighton, they were in the Cup Final 15 years ago. They were a first division side. You know, I can't think of my equipment. Norwich City crashing and burning. You can't envisage it. So ours was the kind of the first of the bigger stories. We're not mentioned in the same breath as the likes of Portsmouth and Bolton and Bury because it's a generation ago. But for us, it's still fresh. Mm. And it's still, you know, it's the reason why, you know, as Alex was saying about, you know, we've got this wonderful stadium, we're in the Premier League. But the backstory is, for me, something which must be passed down generation to generation. Remember where we came from, because this is who we are.
Mm. I think the other side of that, Alan, as well, is about the reason I mentioned Aldershot then, is since 97, and particularly since the millennium, there have been dozens of clubs now in this position. You know, Bolton and Bury are the latest, but there's been Cambridge United, Chester, Wrexham, even Leeds to an extent, the great Peter Ridsdale. Mm. The fit and proper persons test was brought in 2003 or 2004. And it's made not a jot of difference. Mm. We're still getting these asset-stripping owners coming into our clubs. And ruining clubs. I mean, the Bury situation was the owner owed 26 million on his own debts and was using Gig Lane as collateral against the loans. Mm. And it's all come tumbling down.
Mm. It's absolutely ridiculous. And like I said, the lessons need to be learned. And like I said, you mentioned the fit.
Well, the lessons are there to be learned. And I think there's people at the top of the English Football League. And I am actually going to name names here. I think that the likes of the outgoing, I think he's actually gone now. Sean Harvey has an awful lot of things to answer for. It's on his watch. He can claim that we did this, this, and this, but company law says that, that, and that. Well, actually, because what you've got is that it's like the Premier League. The Premier League is a kind of an umbrella organisation. Its members are the clubs. The Football League, it's the same. It's just 72. If you want to have a fit and proper persons test, you're actually talking about clubs voting against them, you know, their own sense of scrutiny. And for me, and I haven't thought this through, but I'm just wondering if there ought to be some kind of quasi-judicial body like Ofcom, like Ofgem, like, you know, that actually regulates maybe football, but certainly sport generally. Because this is business that's actually taking hold of things which are actually non-business issues. And I think there needs to be some kind of overarching body, or just an overseer that says, that actually has the proper teeth. Because, like I say, it's, I hate the phrase, it's a politician's ones. You've got turkeys voting for Christmas with this. Yeah. And Steve Dale actually has a vote on whether the fit and proper persons test can be administered. And that's not right, surely.
But the thing is, the thing that really grates me about the whole thing is you see some, I mean, classic examples are people like Man United supporters who live in Guildford and say, why should I care about Bury? They don't understand the fact that these clubs are the heart of their communities. Mm. That's why you should care. If we'd have lost the club, they'd be ripped the album back then. They'd have ripped the heart out of the community. So same with Bury, same with Bolton, same with all of these places.
It's not just a big city.
I mean, a lot of these people think it's about like 22 blokes kicking a bag of air around a bit of grass on a Saturday afternoon. It's not. It's about community, about belonging. It's more than that.
Draw breath.
Yeah.
Back to the book. Do you actually sort of touch on this, Nick?
Yes, I do. There are two chapters in here. One centred on Wrexham because it's where I ended up living for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And the battle Wrexham had in 2003, 2005. And then revisited in a really lovely fashion when we drew them in the FA Cup in 2012. Mm. And going back to the ground there and everything that happened then. Meanwhile, my son, who is now 17, having taken him to probably at least a dozen Brighton games when he was little, suddenly turned to me on the eve of that cup game and said, "Dad, but I don't support Brighton. I support Wrexham."
Ooh. How did you feel about that?
Well, he said, "All my friends at school do." And up to that point, he dallied with following Arsenal, but I sort of talked him out of that one. I couldn't talk him out of Wrexham, and even to this day, he still supports Wrexham.
I have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever.
Well, if he's from that neck of the woods, it makes sense, doesn't it?
He spent 7 or 8 years of his life there.
Alex, do you support Toronto?
They did win the MLS the first year I moved there, and then the basketball team won the NBA this year. So, you know, I'm kind of bandwagoning the Toronto teams.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously the CPL is, which Paul Byrne was talking about earlier. Mm. He's behind that. How is that taking off? Is it still in its formative stages? Or
yeah, it's still very new. I would also say that although it's technically a professional league, when you have the MLS. the desire to go and see a lesser professional league is not really there. But they are trying to choose cities and places that don't have teams, so like Hamilton,
Winnipeg,
places like Winnipeg, etc. So the team in Toronto is called York Nine, which is in North York. It's a suburb of Toronto. So where I live, which is downtown, it's like I can either walk 10 minutes to watch an MLS game or take an hour on transit to go and watch what is, you know, a lesser standard. But yeah, it's good for the game, especially with the World Cup going there in a few years. So.
Cool. Okay, Nick.
You,
in your hand, you are holding a wonderful copy of your book. And somebody out there listening to this right now can win this very book.
More than that. Two people. We're giving away two copies of Nick's new book, Death in Grimsby. All you have to do is email us at thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk with the correct answer to this question, Nick, which he cannot remember.
Yes, the question has something to do with, yes.
Yeah.
Which club connects the Albion's two leading post-war goal scorers, Kit Napier and Glenn Murray?
Obviously, other than Brighton.
Yes. So the only hint will be it's a northern club.
Yes. So if you can put down your answer to that question, which club is common between, apart from Brighton, between Kit Napier and Glenn Murray? Send your answer to thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk, and we'll be giving away two copies of Death in Grimsby, and we'll be announcing the winner at next week's show. Good luck, everyone.
Yep, absolutely. And with that, that is actually all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much for coming all the way from Toronto just to see us.
Just quickly before we go, Nick, how do we get hold of a copy of your book?
Yeah, the book is available through Amazon, all outlets of Amazon at the moment, £10.49.
Okay,
£10.49, postage and packing free. It can also be ordered on eBay from me. And also, if people want a signed copy, if they email me at SeagullNick, that's Nick without a K, SeagullNick@gmail.com, and I can arrange them to send me a PayPal payment and send them a signed copy.
Fantastic. Okay. And the unsigned ones
are worth
a lot more. Sorry.
So
yes.
Thank you. So you, Alan Wes,
thank you very much.
Alex Jones, thank you. Nick Alexide, thank you very much. I'm Eddie Packham, and we're all a little bit tangled up in blue.
The sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress, Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force.